We are in week number one of a new series that we have titled In the Beginning. And so what we will be doing through this series is talking about some similarities, and it may not necessarily be what you think it might be. So we're excited to do that. But before we jump into that, I think Carrie has a challenge for you guys.
All right, so your 2024 challenge. So we are being fairly intentional about this series and the messages that we're doing between Christmas and Easter this year because, Christmas wouldn't really matter if it hadn't been for Easter. And to me, Easter is the pinnacle of the Christian faith, what it represents. And, it was the initiation moment for the church. So your challenge is that in the 12 weeks between now and Easter, read through the Gospels. Now, if that's too overwhelming, because there's four books, if it's too overwhelming, pick one. Last year, I encouraged everybody to read through Luke and then Acts. And if you want to do that again, then that would be awesome too, because Luke is very Luke and Acts are kind of written together. It's kind of one book, but two separate books. But it kind of flows through the whole narrative of the story between what happened on Christmas and what happened on Easter. And there were a lot of years in between that point, you know, because Jesus didn't go from baby to like 30-something year olds in 12 weeks. But we're going to kind of study through it that way. I would also encourage you guys to just take this time of year to just kind of really dig into the story of Jesus and his ministry and the time. I've recommended it before, but if you haven't watched The Chosen, I would recommend watching The Chosen. I don't normally watch shows like that very often, but I've watched it twice, and I'm probably about to watch it a third time. It's fantastic. It's beautifully made, but it does a great job of sharing who Jesus was and the upside-down kingdom that he came to initiate. So last year, I think it was between Christmas and Easter that we watched it, and it really felt like it gave Easter kind of a different feel for me last year. So if you're a visual person like me, then watching something like The Chosen is a really great way to kind of see the scripture with a little bit more imagery. So, but that's my challenge, is read through the Gospels, or at least one of the Gospel accounts before Easter.
That's good.
12 weeks.
Let's do it. All right, so everyone, this time of year, you're thinking about your new beginnings, you're thinking about resolutions and goals and plans and hopes. Okay, how many of you made a New Year's resolution? Okay. How many of you have already broken your New Year's resolution? Thank you for being honest. So this time of year, it's that time of year, right? We it's like there's something that is in our brains. It's like a reset in our brains where at the beginning of a new year, it feels like everything can be new, like the world can be ours. We can get healthy. We can get in shape. We can do better with our finances. We can do all of these things. And a lot of times that can be true. I've seen, I don't know how many of you are on LinkedIn, but it seems like on LinkedIn, there's just all of my friends are, I started a new position at, or I got a promotion at, and it's just like one after another of people that are using this time of year to really literally make a brand new start for themselves. And so that can be really exciting and gives you a chance to become a better you.
So it's kind of a weird thing because it really is just like from one day to the next. Like there's nothing like tangible that really changes. It's more of a mindset kind of thing. And has anyone ever heard of the Latin phrase tabula rasa? A few of you. Back in like the 90s, there was a song. Who sang that, Chris? Do you know? There was like a song that was called tabula rasa, and that was the first time I'd ever heard of it. But it's a Latin phrase that it basically just means clean slate. So where the phrase came from is back in, you know, Latin times, they had tablets, and they would cover them with wax. And instead of just writing on the tablet, they would cover it with wax so they could take notes on it, but then they could heat the wax, smooth it out, and start with a clean slate. They could start fresh again. So it was a, it wasn't a new slate, but it was a clean slate. It was a fresh slate. And it was ready to make new impressions into the wax. So I thought that was kind of a, that's kind of a cool phrase kind of going into the new year, kind of explaining the mindset that we have. It's okay, everything that happened last year, it happened last year, but now we can move forward. This is a, it's not, you know, we're not a brand new us, but we have a chance to make some fresh impressions. So.
Yep. So in Genesis, starting from the beginning, just like we said we would, Genesis 1:1-2, it says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now this, the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters." And so when we see this, we see that God's creation was like this wax tablet, right? It was a completely blank slate. God had the creative liberty of doing whatever he wished he wanted to do with the world. He could do it. And when he did, he designed it to be filled with beauty, with peace, a place where his presence could abound and dwell. And then he created Adam and Eve as a part of this creation. And so if we continue reading on, Genesis 1:27 says, "God blessed them and said to them, 'Be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over every living creature that moves on the ground.'" And so humans were created with this divine purpose of cultivating and creating the reflection of God's image. In other words, God made this beautiful creation, and then he set us up to be able to manage this beautiful creation. He created us to be a reflection of himself in the world that we are a part of.
So it's kind of like the way I see it is the original creation was just like a bunch of raw material. And it's like a potter that has a lump of clay that he can use to create something more from it. Now, he did not create the clay, but he can use the clay to make something new. And that's kind of how God's original creation was. It was something that God provided, and then he gave to man in order to be able to further create something with. So that's what we mean when we say to cultivate and create along with God. And that creation, that further creation, was meant to reflect the image of God on earth. So everything that was created was supposed to be done with the character and the heart of God flowing through the man. But it didn't last very long. So in the beginning, God's creation, it reflected perfection. It reflected his beauty of his character. But then humanity kind of messed it up, because that's kind of what we like to do, isn't it? Like we can have something and we can mess it up pretty easy. So when humanity messed it up, God promised that he would make a way for his presence to be with them again. So long story short, and I feel like we've covered Genesis a lot, so we're not going to go really deep into the story of the fall and everything. If you have questions later that you want to talk about, then we can talk about that with you guys later. But basically, God's presence had to be separated when sin entered in. So because God's purity, it was so pure that he could not exist where sin existed. But he didn't give up on humanity after Adam's fall. So over the thousands of years, we see a pattern here. We see that God, he made promises to Abraham. He rescued the Israelites over and over and over again. And he sent numerous prophets to speak on his behalf, but none of it was enough. No one man was enough to be able to change the narrative and help return creation back to that pure state, a place where God's presence could fully dwell and exist with them.
Yeah, and, you know, as this is happening, this cycle is happening over and over again, we see that humanity itself, you know, it's like they make a deal with God and they make this covenant together, and everything seems to be going great with this covenant, and then all of a sudden everything just kind of goes south. And a lot of it was just this human nature, this thing that lives and resides within us that wants us to fall back to the ways of the world. And so Adam's curse was kind of unavoidable at this point, because it's really was just kind of a part of this humanistic nature of this free will that we have that God grants to us that allows us to not be in his presence if we should choose to be so. And so it would take then this perfect man or a perfect man to overcome this curse. And so in the beginning stages, everything was supposed to be perfect. Everything was supposed to be this wonderful place where we could reside in God's presence and be in his peace and not have to worry about the things that are happening around us, and not even so much so that we would have a care in the world, but yet he programmed us with the ability to step out of that on our own and be able to be in an existence without God, which is really an interesting thing. But then it would take Jesus, or it would take a perfect man to overcome this curse.
So why do you think that God would create people with the ability to not? Wouldn't it be easier if God just created man, like in this linear sort of thought process of like not making mistakes? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Like, so.
Do you want to go into that? Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, you can, you know, it's like humans create robots, right? And so we create these robots and we program them to do certain things, and they don't get a choice on whether or not they do those particular things. And the only time that robots ever mess up is if, number one, a part messes up and it fails, or number two, if we program it wrong, right? And so God would have never programmed humanity wrong, right? He programmed us correctly. He programmed us in a way that we could reside with him and be with him in his presence. But at the same time, he offered us the ability to have free will and to think on our own, because he didn't want us to be robots. He wanted us to choose God. He wanted us to have that decision to be able to say, I want to choose to be in God's presence. Otherwise, we wouldn't necessarily have the ability to think on our own. We would just all be on the same super weird cycle of the same thing happening over and over and over again. And as we know, as humanity, we've evolved as humanity throughout time, and we've become we've found ways to grow closer to God. We've learned more about God. We've grown in ourselves. I mean, way back in the day with the Catholic Church, they only had one Bible sitting on a pulpit and no one else had access to it, right? So as Christianity has evolved and we've had more access and more knowledge, we've grown closer to God. And so I would say that's why, because God desired a real, true relationship with somebody, not just a robot saying, I love you, right? Because we can program a robot to do that.
So I know, like, as a mom, it would be my job a whole lot easier if my kids were just pre-programmed to just obey and to say, I love you on command, and to do... Don't give me that face.
Push the button. Boop.
But it would be a lot easier. But also, I would have that hollow feeling of knowing that it's not by their choice. That there's a big difference in knowing, like when I see, when I tell them to take their dishes to the sink after we eat dinner, then I'm just telling them what to do. But when they get up from the table and they pick up that plate and they dump their trash and they put it in the sink all by themselves, that's a moment. Like, that is a mom win moment right there. And that means something. When they choose to come up to me and hug me, that's a mom moment. Like, that's an exciting moment. It means something. If I force affection, if I force obedience, then it just doesn't mean as much. It just really doesn't mean anything. It's just me being in control of who they are. And honestly, I think it would strip them of their personalities.
Yeah, and that's it. It strips them of their personalities. And the other piece of that, too, is, you know, people say, well, God doesn't need affection, or he doesn't need my love, or he doesn't need humanity's love. And that's probably true. But he did create something that was beautiful, right? Like, humanity is beautiful for the most part, except for when we fight. But overall, humanity is this beautiful creation, and we've created this beautiful place. And that's part of it, too, is that if we didn't have our expression of ourselves, then the world wouldn't look the way that it looks today, or it wouldn't have looked like it did 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago. Humanity would be totally different, and everything would be square boxes, and, you know, it's like black and white versus, like, the colors of the rainbow, because at this point, our freedom, our expression of who we are, is what God desired for us. And so it's not just so that he can have somebody to love him as much as it is that he desired for us to have that freedom of expression of who we are.
So in a nutshell, throughout the entire Old Testament, we see a lot of personality, a lot of free will, a lot of decisions. And there were good decisions, but then there were bad decisions. There were good people that made bad decisions. And so nobody over thousands of years, over generations, was able to step into that role of being the person that could fully represent God's character on earth and do so in a way that would allow God's presence to return to earth. So enter Jesus.
Enter Jesus. And so it's the first time since Adam that when Jesus enters the scene, it's the first time since Adam that a man had appeared on earth without a human father. Every other human on earth had had a earthly father, and Jesus was the first one since Adam that had a heavenly father. And so as the Son of God, Jesus was perfect and sinless. And unlike Adam, he remained that way, right? So Adam and Jesus are both born from a heavenly being or birthed from a heavenly source. And Adam was born perfect and sinless. Like, when he was born without sin, without blemish. Jesus was the same, born without blemish. But he was able to maintain that status of perfect and sinless throughout his entire life.
So there's this whole, like, theological theory about how Jesus is the second Adam or the last Adam. And has anyone ever heard, like, Jesus referred to as first or last Adam? So we could get in a really, really, really deep rabbit hole. And if you guys ever want to chase the rabbit with me, I would love to do that because it's really cool stuff. But we're going to cover some parallels between Adam and Jesus. So Adam was the first man, and he was created directly by God. And so he is the symbolic head of humanity. Jesus is the first God-man. He is the direct son of God, and he is the head of the church or of the new humanity. So both entered the world sinless, but Adam failed and Jesus succeeded. So in 1 Corinthians 15, starting in verse 21, it says, "For since death came through a man, the resurrection of the dead comes also through a man. For as in Adam all die, so in Christ all will be made alive." So Adam sinned once, and he doomed all of humanity to living in a broken world. Adam invited sin into the world. And I know it was Adam and Eve, but let's face it, a lot of biblical scholars like to focus on the patriarch, so we're just going to do that. So we'll just talk about Adam this time. So Adam doomed all of humanity to live in a broken world by inviting sin into the world. So Jesus died once, and he repaired the brokenness of all of humanity. So what Adam broke, Jesus healed. Do you want me to read the song?
I can, yeah.
Do you want to?
I can do it. All right, so this is Romans 5:12-9. It says, therefore, just as sin entered the world through one man, and death through sin, and in this way death came to all people because all sinned. To be sure, sin was in the world before the law was given, but sin is not charged against anyone's account where there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from the time of Adam to the time of Moses, even over those who did not sin by breaking a command, as did Adam, who is a pattern of one to come.
Okay, so basically that section is just saying, like, and if you have your Bibles, be sure and flip to that. It was Romans
12:5-12.
Okay, because we're going to kind of track a little bit with that. So this is saying that, like, Adam invited the sin into the world. He invited the brokenness into the world, created that division between God and humanity. And so that brokenness or that death that he invited into the world, it reigned throughout the whole Old Testament. So the law was given as an opportunity to overcome that, as an opportunity to kind of mend that. And some people were able to live under the law and do it fairly well. I don't know how. There were so many laws. There were over 600 laws. So I don't know how they were able to do that, but some people were able to mostly live under the law. But the people that were not, because the law was just for the Israelites. So we're doing just a little history lesson here. So the law was just for the Israelites, the family of Abraham. But then that's only one family. That's only one nation. The rest of the nations of the world, as it says here, that those that were not under the law were not held accountable to the law. If you don't know the rules, how can you follow the rules? So that's kind of all kind of wrapping up the whole Old Testament of saying, like, why the law was given, but also the law was only for a select few. Does that make sense?
Yeah. All right, so if we continue reading on, but the gift is not like the trespass. For if the many died by the trespass of one man, how much more did God's grace and the gift that came by the grace of one man, Jesus Christ, overflow to the many? Nor can the gift of God be compared with the result of one man's sin. The judgment followed one sin and brought condemnation. But the gift followed many trespasses and brought justification. For if by the trespass of one man death reigned through the one man, how much more will those who receive God's abundant provision of grace and if the gift of righteousness reign in the life through the one man, Jesus Christ? Sum that up for us, Carrie.
Basically, what one man broke, one man can fix. So it's saying that what Adam broke, then Jesus, and the gift that it's talking about is the sacrifice of Jesus, his surrender over to death, and his resurrection is the gift that offered that repair to the brokenness that could fix the sin.
And then lastly, consequently, just as one trespass resulted in condemnation for all people, so also one righteous act resulted in justification and life for all people. For just as though the disobedience of one man, the many were made sinners, so also through the obedience of one man, the many will be made righteous. And I think that just kind of sums up the story of Adam and Jesus, that one man was able to make sin abound for many, whereas it only took the death of Jesus for us to be freed from those transgressions.
So I like metaphors. And so when I think about this, it's hard to imagine like that one decision, that one bad decision, that one sin could cause a problem for so many people. But I think about like baking cookies. If you accidentally made the decision, instead of putting in a cup of sugar, you put in a cup of salt, then that's going to ruin the entire batch. And it's going to affect anybody that takes a bite of those cookies. So in that way, the best way to repair the situation is to make a new batch of cookies. So Adam added the salt, but through Jesus, he was able to make a new batch of cookies. It was a new beginning. It was a fresh start. It was that tabula rasa that was able to come in and change things, to repair it and to make it good again in a way that can affect many. It's kind of a silly metaphor, but I think you guys get it, maybe. A few of you. So Adam represents our human nature. In 1 Corinthians 15:45, it says, "So it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living being, the last Adam, or man, a life-giving spirit. The spiritual did not come first, but the natural, and after that, the spiritual. The first man was of the dust of the earth, the second man is of heaven. As was the earthly man, so are those who are of the earth. And as is the heavenly man, so also are those who are of heaven." Who picked these scriptures? These are all like... These are some... Like, I would highly encourage you guys to go and, like, read through these passages on your own. Because these are the kind of passages that takes reading and rereading and re-re-re-reading a few times before it starts to kind of settle in, because it seems like a riddle. Like, it almost seems like a puzzle that you have to kind of put together a little bit. So sum that up.
Okay, so, but let's talk about that for a second. So if that, yes, it seems like a riddle, but why in Corinthians would they compare Adam to Jesus? Like, what would be the reasoning for doing that? Carrie?
So in Corinthians, Paul was writing to the church of Corinth, and he was trying to explain to them, to draw out to them who Jesus really was. Because they knew of Jesus, they knew of the apostle Jesus, they knew of the prophet, the teacher, the man. But what he's trying to do here is he's trying to explain that Jesus was more than just a man, that he is the second man is of heaven. That he is from heaven, that he is fully God and fully man. And so Paul is kind of fleshing that. That's funny. So Paul's kind of fleshing that out right there for them, trying to explain in detail what it meant that Jesus died and what it means for them. And in doing so, he is explaining the accessibility, the process of salvation.
Yeah, and not to mention that he's using prophetic words from the Old Testament that the Israelites would have understood and they would have been studying since they were a child to explain to them who God really was or who Jesus was when he came to this earth. And so the language sometimes can be confusing because you're like, why does he say that? But it often will, if you look, it'll connect to an Old Testament prophecy. And so they're just explaining it through using those Old Testament Torah prophecies. So, so secondly, Jesus imparts to us his spiritual nature. So while Adam is imparting to us or representing our humanistic nature, Jesus is imparting to us his spiritual nature. And once again, 1 Corinthians 15:49 says, "And just as we have borne the image of the earthly man, so shall we bear the image of the heavenly man."
And that in itself is a return to Eden. the return to the original in the beginning, when the garden was created in perfection, when God's Spirit was able to dwell among humanity, with humanity, in peace and in purity and beauty, really. And that's the image of the heavenly man. But Jesus was that image. Jesus was able to show how to walk in a broken world in that image and still reflect God's character. So it's a return to Eden, not so much the physical world becoming the garden again, but that Eden being planted inside of us and growing inside of us. It's little, like little pockets of Eden walking around the earth.
Yeah, and so when Adam and Eve, what they ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, their eyes were opened and they realized they were naked. Now, when I read this, I was like, okay, why was it such a big deal for them to have this realization? Like, I don't understand that piece of it. Like, why is it a big deal? And then I started thinking about it, and it's not just so much that they realized that they were naked. It was that they realized for the first time in their lives that they were vulnerable. And so when you think about it, when you were a child, when you were very, very small, an infant, there's this moment where it's like you have this trust with your mom and with your dad and with the house that you live in. And so as an infant, you don't really have like any fears. You don't really have any vulnerability. You don't really have, like, you trust that your parents are going to feed you. You trust that you're going to be taken care of. And so you really don't have anything to fear. And so when you see infants, a lot of times they're not having nightmares. They're not having bad dreams. They're not whatever, until like a certain point. And there's a certain point where like we get introduced to something in the world that maybe scares us just a little bit, right? Or it terrifies us, or maybe it's a bad experience that happens to us as a child. And so then all of a sudden we become vulnerable to the world. We see that in the world there's not just good, but there's also bad in the world. And so when we're talking about Adam and Eve eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, it may not necessarily have been a physical piece of fruit. It may have literally been exactly what it says it is, which is the knowledge that there is good and that there is, in fact, evil. And so when it talks about them realizing that they're naked, it's kind of like when you're an infant and you have this moment happen in your life that scares you and you realize that there's bad in the world. Adam and Eve, this happens to them in this moment. It's like, whoa, 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 God, I didn't know that there was bad in this world. I thought that it was all only good, right? And honestly, that's what Satan promised them, that you will become like God. Why? Because now you know the truth, that there's good with the world and that there's bad with the world. And now I'm going to have to expose you to that because of the choice that you made. And so when we're talking about this, it's interesting because what Jesus did to counteract that is that he actually comes to the earth to counteract that vulnerability of us not having salvation because we had to follow a certain set of rules or laws. And so with Jesus' death, we see that he is actually counteracting that moment of vulnerability to where we have assurance, we have hope in who we are as believers. What's interesting is Jesus is also tempted as well. So Adam and Eve were tempted. Jesus was tempted as well. And he was tempted at a time where he was very vulnerable, right? He had been fasting for 40 days in the wilderness. Sound familiar, Israelites, right? And so he'd been fasting for 40 days in the wilderness, and he was hungry, and he was ready to give in to the temptations of the flesh and consume some food, right? And so when Satan tempts him, that's the first thing he tempts him with, right? Is the desires of the flesh, that food, that bread. He's like, turn that rock into a piece of bread. And Jesus says, no, I'm not going to do it. And then he goes on to tempt him two more times with power and with might and with the ability to rule over humans and all of these things. And yet Jesus is able to deny Satan every single time. And so when we say, when we talk, you know, talking about Jesus and thinking about Jesus, he literally went through the same things that Adam and Eve went through. It's not that he had an easy go at life or that he was never tempted or that he wasn't ever in a position to make the wrong decision, because he was. In the exact same way, had Jesus turned that rock into bread, it would have been no different than Adam and Eve picking a piece of fruit off of a tree and consuming it. Jesus was tempted in the same exact way. And here's why this is important. Adam didn't deny the fruit. He gave in to the temptation. And when he does this, he gives in to humanistic nature. He gives in to the tendencies of us as humanity to say that I have this on my own. I can do this on my own. It's dog eat dog, and I am the bigger dog, right? It's this nature inside of us that just wants to return back to that natural tendency, and we all do it from time to time, where it's like, okay, God, I don't need your way of living. I don't need the things that you have to offer me, because I want to live out my life in the way that I want to live it out. However, what this does is it makes us vulnerable to the world, right? When we reject God, when we reject his ways, when we say no to God, it makes us very vulnerable to this world. And so when we give in to our humanistic natures, in a moment, we might think that we're gaining power or influence, but what we're actually doing is opening ourselves up to making ourselves vulnerable to the evils of this world. Every decision that we make that's more humanistic, it opens us up more and more and more for those things to come flooding in, where we're having to defend ourselves and we're having to fight for ourselves. Do you want to say, add something? Yeah.
So what kind of strikes me about that is that Eden was perfect. They had everything that they needed and they didn't have to work for it. It was available. It was accessible. The chances are that Adam and Eve had never actually experienced hunger. They didn't know the physical feeling of hunger because it was just there. They didn't know what it was like to be without. They didn't have any, like, they were in the power seat. They had power. They had authority to rule over all of the rest of creation. They had it all. And yet they gave in because they wanted more. Jesus was God come to earth. In order to do so, he also had it all. He had the power. He had the authority. He had no need for physical food or anything like that. But he surrendered. We talk a lot about the surrender of his life. But just coming to earth was a surrender. To experience physical hunger. To experience being a lower class citizen. To experience poverty. To experience prejudice. And he gave all that up, knowing what he was giving up. And that was kind of the reversal, the power shift, you might say. Because knowing what it would mean, he still made the decision. Knowing physical hunger in the desert when he was being tempted, he didn't give in. Knowing what it felt like to have the power, he still didn't give in. He remained in his lowly position. And so that's what surrender, that's what God's, or Jesus' surrender really is. It was that every single day of deciding to remain in the position he was in. And that's a complete reversal of where Adam was.
Yeah, and so when we talk about Satan tempting and when we talk about those types of things, he doesn't have any new tricks, right? He uses the same tricks over and over and over to lure us in with the desires of the flesh, with power, with the ability to have wisdom and knowledge and to gain things. And it's always about getting that next best thing, right? Like, it's always about taking that action step and getting that next thing. But the reality is that when we learn to be more like Christ and we deny these types of temptations, we actually become less vulnerable to the evil of the world. We sleep better at night. We can be more confident in our future. And we have a hope and a future with God. And so when we discuss all of this, we talk about being more like Christ and we talk about denying ourselves, a lot of times we project things onto that, or we say, I can remember back in the day, right, when I was in church, my mom used to tell me stories of her church, and they would say things like, well, you can't go to the movies because that's worldly, or you can't go dancing because that's worldly, or you can't do blah, 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 right? And it's always like kind of ebbed and flowed throughout humanity. It's like, what's the next thing we're going to pick on that's going to be earthly, right? But here's the thing. Like, I understand that. I understand there are some things that are worldly. But in Romans 12:2, it says to don't copy the behavior and customs of this world, but let God transform you into a new person by changing the way that you think. Then you will learn to know God's will for you, which is good and pleasing and perfect. And so when we talk about not copying the behaviors or the customs of this world, it's not necessarily about the things that you're doing. It's about the action steps that you are taking, right? And so when we are not copying the things of this world, we're not copying the humanistic nature of Adam. We're not copying the humanistic nature of the people who came before us. We're having to constantly evolve and grow as humanity in ourselves and knowing different ways that we can be more like Christ in loving others. And so when we think about things that happen in our daily lives and we think about the things that we do on a regular basis, we have to sit down and ask ourselves some questions around, what are the things that I'm doing that are of heavenly nature, and what are the things that I'm doing that are of a humanistic nature? And the number one thing I'll tell you to look for in that is the thing that you're doing someone causing someone else grief? Is the thing that you're doing causing harm to someone else, or hatred towards someone else, or hatred towards yourself, right? And if the answer to that is yes, it's probably more humanistic. If you ask yourself, am I doing this to try to get ahead? Am I doing this to try to gain power? Am I trying to do this to gain control? More than likely, the answer is going to be, hey, that's of humanistic nature, right? But when we think about the heavenly nature of things, when we ask ourselves those questions, those are the types of decisions we need to be turning around so that we can grow closer to Christ and then we can grow closer to God.
So I guess the question is what are we willing to surrender? Like, what are we willing to give up to be able to be a part of the shalom, the peace of God, to be a part of the new creation? What is it that is keeping us from being a part of that new creation fully, fully surrendered? And that's not something that anybody can answer for you. That's something that you have to work out with God on your own. And I would highly encourage you guys to take some time and just ask God, just be prepared, but ask God, what am I holding on to? What is it that I need to let go of to you? What do I need to trust you with? What do I need to surrender to you, and be prepared, because he answers those prayers. You'll find out. It may not be in the way that you expect it, but you'll figure it out pretty quick. So, yeah.
All right, let's say a prayer, and then we'll be dismissed for the day. Dear Heavenly Father, we come to you today, and we're so thankful that you sent your son, Jesus Christ, to come and to live on this earth and to show us the way forward, a way to live in a spiritual nature, away from human nature, so that when we are here on this earth, God, we can truly be alive. We can truly have life while we're here, and that we don't live in such a way that we are self-destructive or humanistic or destructive towards others. So God, I pray today that each and every one of us that are in this room, that we would make a conscious decision today to live in such a way that it would be in a nature of the heavenly realms, God, that we would choose to live more like Christ. Because when we do, God, when we make that decision and we live in it and we walk in it every single day, God, we become less vulnerable to the evils of this world. And it doesn't necessarily mean that bad things won't happen to us, because they are going to happen. But when those bad things do happen, God, you give us peace, you give us hope, and a future. So even on the worst situation, even upon our death, God, we have a hope and a future, which makes us free from the fears of death, free from the fears of a curse, free from the fears of those things in our lives that we are running from. So I pray today, God, that as we make those conscious decisions, that you would take those vulnerabilities away, that you would allow us to live a life that is free and clear of the patterns that happen in this world, the cycles that are happening in this world, free from addictions, free from pain, free from all of those things that plague us as humanity, God. God, you never promised that the world would be perfect, but you promised us that you would be with us. And because you sent your son, you made a way. And we are so grateful for that opportunity to live in shalom and peace with you. We love you, God. We thank you for everything you're doing in and through our hearts and our minds and our bodies. Go with us this week and allow us to dwell upon your thoughts. And that's all this we ask in your name. Amen.